My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick, and this is Sonatotum, episode 99. Hello, my friends. On this and every episode of Sonatotum, we talk about making stuff, mostly writing, finding success as we each define it for ourselves, and staying healthy and sane in the process. I am your host, of course, Matthew Wayne Selznick. I am myself an author and creator, and my day job is helping other authors, podcasters, and creators bring their own work to fruition, to market, and to the people who should be experiencing it. Today on the show, we have another in-depth conversation with an author, with a writer. Today, we have Maureen Morrissey, and here's what it says about Maureen in her biography. She's a writer for online publications and a published novelist. She's a retired educator and a wife, mother, grandmother, and dog mommy. She's an amateur photographer, traveler who loves to wander and wonder. And most recently, as of earlier in 2024, a half marathon runner, which is pretty cool. In Maureen's spare time, she attends live theater events and rock concerts and investigates the integrity of rooftop bars in her hometown, New York City. Maureen has been a writer for as long as she remembers. She began writing her first novel, Woven, Six Stories, One Epic Journey, in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic, the day after retiring from teaching fourth grade. It was published in November of 2020. She published a second novel, Sonder, Janine's Story, in March 2022, and her third, Seeing is Believing, in June 2023. She published a short story, Win, Lose, or Draw, at the beginning of January 2024. And you can find Maureen at MaureenMorrissey.com. Let me spell that for you. MaureenMorrissey.com. This was a fun conversation. We talked about that first novel and how things kind of developed from there. Maureen is someone who, it could be said, got a, and this is of course all relative, late start as a published author, but she had a ton of experience before that, writing articles in her field and other things. But this is kind of a first novelist's story. And also a little different from the authors you might normally hear on the show here. Maureen is primarily a historical fiction and literary fiction writer. I think you're going to get a lot out of the conversation. I know I always say that, but that's because I believe it. These talks with writers, these evergreen conversations that I'm so privileged to have, they all reflect a different aspect of the creative writing life. And at the same time, I think you'll start to see commonalities that you probably share as well. The conversation, I think I might have mentioned, was recorded on January 18th, 2024. It is April 10th, 2024, as I speak to you today from the lush and lavish studios of MWS Media in Huntington Beach, California. So a little bit of time has passed since our conversation, but again, these conversations are meant to stand the test of time. So why don't we get into it? Here is my conversation with author Maureen Morrissey. Maureen Morrissey, what do you create?
Right now, I'm creating a lot of different types of writing. So I just published this past summer my third novel, and then about 3 weeks ago, I just published my first short story book. So I create, hopefully, stories and and characters with my words that other people can enjoy. What else do I create? I do love photography. It's snowing here in New York, and I have a couple of bird feeders out back. So in the winter, I love to create winter photos to share. So photography is another one of the things I love to create. And both of those go way back to my childhood.
Well, that's an excellent segue. I want to get deeper into the actual stuff you make, but you provided the perfect doorway to what is always my follow-up question, which is, why do you create?
I create because I feel like I have something to say. And that's a very New York answer. A lot of us feel that way. I come from a place where stories surrounded me growing up, and a lot of visuals were around me growing up. And my own view of those was different than the view of other people around me. And we did a lot, my friends and I, my family and I, did a lot of talking, a lot of sharing. And so I think I share because I think it's important to do so. I think everyone has a story to tell in some way or another. And so I want to make sure that I tell mine.
You said story surrounded you and there were a lot of visuals, but what perked up my ears was that your interpretation of those visuals was different from others. What did you mean by that?
I grew up with a couple of other people who also liked photography. I'll start with that. And we were very fortunate in the New York City public school system. We went to a school that had a dark room for developing our own photos. And so it was the early 1970s in New York City. I'm not sure how much you or your listeners would know about that period of time in New York City, but it wasn't pretty. It wasn't right. An easy place for a teenage girl to grow up, and it wasn't clean, and it was a little scary. And so we would take our cameras out into the city and take photos and then meet back in the dark room. And what always struck me was their visions versus my visions of where we were growing up and the time that we were living in. I seem to favor taking photos of the people that I saw, where one of my close friends would often take photos of architecture. Another one was really into whatever little nature she could find. And we spent a lot of time in Central Park. But a lot of my photos from back then are of my friends hanging out on the streets, just being young teenage girls. They're all in black and white. And I think that's what I mean, is we all grew up in the same space at the same time, but all of us focused on very different things in our photography.
And what do you think it was that had you pointing your camera at other people rather than, like you said, nature and architecture and whatnot? Is it connected to the fact that, you know, you had said story surrounded you, so you already were kind of thinking in that sort of narrative way?
I'm going to say absolutely. And I will say I do love taking photos of trees and sunsets and birds.
Sure.
And for the peaceful factor of it, but any photo you have with a person in it, their body language, the expression on their face, what they're wearing, to me, it's always been about story. I grew up loving stories, hearing them, telling them. One of my oldest memories at the age of 5 is walking myself a mile to the nearest public library and just getting lost in the stacks for hours till they basically threw me out. I could not get enough of the books that they had there and would always carry home as much as I could. Yes, for me, it's a story.
So, okay, a story was everywhere and it was part of your life from an early age. Go a little deeper on that. Who was telling these stories and what specifically was happening in your life, in your family life? Did you have other writers in your family or just a strong oral tradition? Or go tell me a little more about that.
So I think I'll begin with saying I'm first generation American, and the majority of my friends were also first generation Americans back in the 60s and 70s in New York City. We came from all over the world. And so we all grew up with hearing stories about why our families left their home countries and left everything and everyone they knew to start life over again in a big city where they didn't speak the language. And so I grew up hearing stories about their families, but my own story, which many years later was fodder for my first novel. I fictionalized a lot of my family stories to write my first novel. My parents, my father is a Holocaust survivor, and my mother is a Holocaust refugee. And the stories that they shared about their experiences, that they were children at the time, really made an impression on me, really taught me some tough life lessons at a very young age, but also taught me the importance of sharing those stories. So, like I said, years later, when I wrote my first novel, my idea was to not let those stories die, because most of the people in that generation are gone or quite elderly with memory issues that come with that. And I'm 62, so I see the writing on the wall. So I just wanted to make sure those stories did not die with me. Because I think story and history, which are basically the same thing, are really the most important way for human beings to carry forward, to learn from the past, and to try to do better in the future. That's a lofty answer for that question.
No, I don't think so. I think it's I mean, that's at the core of it, you know. The last person I spoke to for the show just yesterday, they referred to it as hubris. The idea that, you know, I have something to say and I want my words to be remembered. And I kind of countered, and I'm gonna reinforce what you said, was I don't think it's hubris. I think it's responsibility.
I love that. I agree. And I have constant discussions with anyone I can trap long enough and tell to say that whatever your story is, it's really important to share it with other people for your own personal growth as well as theirs. And that kind of sharing, when two strangers start exchanging their life experiences, has a ripple effect. I really believe that.
Indeed. And even if it's not sharing life experiences, even if it is purely fictional, there's, you know, no one, there's only, you know, as the old saw goes, there's only so many stories, but no one is going to tell a particular story the way a particular writer is going to tell it. And I think that's where the responsibility comes in, because the other half of that is we don't know what effect our particular way of telling that particular story is going to have on any one person who experiences it. The implications are literally unpredictable. and the potential is literally unpredictable and unlimited. So yeah, to hell with hubris. I think it's a noble, necessary pursuit, fiction.
Oh, I agree. I agree 100%.
So when did this immersion in story and this love of hearing stories and consuming stories, when did that start to shift over to putting your own stories in tangible form, writing?
I remember when I was 7 years old, I had a publishing center in my room with that very filmy, cheap, manila colored paper that kids were given back in those days. Mm-hmm. And a stapler and scotch tape and my Crayola crayons and probably colored pencils. I don't think I was allowed to use pens in those days in my bedroom. But I started writing ghost stories and illustrating them, which I think my drawing skills have not matured since then. And I tried to sell my mother one for a nickel, and she rejected me. And that was a life lesson. It was a life lesson. At the time, there was a Jewish butcher on around the corner from our house where you could buy a fried chicken wing for a dime, which was a lot of money. Mm-hmm. It was way more money than I had. So I thought if I could sell two stories, I could get a chicken wing. And it was not successful, but it did not stop me. I continued to put my stories out and just keep them for myself at the time. As I got older, I believe I got more into writing school type of work, essays and things like that. I do remember writing a poem in, fourth grade that I thought was hilarious, and my classmates thought was hilarious. The teacher did not think it was hilarious. So another rejection at a very young age. But again, coming from the stock that I came from, adversity and suffering and rejection were kind of in our DNA.
Right.
And again, being a young teenage girl in the 60s and 70s in New York City made you have some pretty thick skin. So I just kept writing and writing and writing. And then I became an educator, a teacher, and I began writing a lot of articles for my colleagues through my professional development I did as a side hustle. And then I was so fortunate to be teaching back in the 80s when writer's workshop was a thing in public elementary schools. And I was taught by the masters of that universe personally on how to run writer's workshop with children. And one of the ways that it was super important to do was to model being a writer yourself. So writing in front of the children, editing and revising in front of the children, sharing your successes and failures and the things you liked and didn't like in front of the children. And through doing that for 37 years, I'm pretty sure I honed my own skills quite a bit.
And in terms of pursuing publication in for your fiction, I mean, obviously you were published, you know, with the articles and whatnot all along. When did that adventure begin?
So as I was teaching elementary school and then having my own children, I began to focus on telling stories to the children, fiction mm-hmm. stories. And then I realized how much they enjoyed some of them. So I tried to get them published. This would have been in the 90s when literary agents were becoming a real thing. And mm-hmm. so you had to apply to a literary agent because you couldn't just drop manuscripts on publishers anymore.
Right.
And yeah. I kept getting rejected by literary agents for children's books that I knew were good and worthy and enjoyed by all kinds of different ages of children, different cultures of children. I did do writing workshops at the time as well, and we published our short stories within our workshop. So I was doing kind of independent publishing long before it even had a term.
Sure.
And I really did get very discouraged by the whole, what I felt was kind of gatekeeping with the literary agents and the publishers. And I knew I had good stuff. And I think the breaking point for me, which drove me towards independently publishing my own work, was when the number one bestseller among children's literature, which would have been when my own kids were still in elementary school, was, I believe the title is, Howie the Farting Dog. And when I read this book, I thought, if this is what they're publishing through, you know, the big four or five,
yeah.
and they're turning down what I considered high quality children's lit, I thought something's wrong. And I just said, I'm kind of done with knocking my head against that wall. And I started indie publishing.
And what year was that?
Well, my first novel came out in 2020. Okay. So it took a while to get to that point where I was ready to publish something.
There's nothing wrong with that because you had the experience with workshopping and all of that over the years to probably know when it was ready more than some might. you know?
I think I'm very fortunate that I think a lot of things just kind of came together mm-hmm. at that point in my life, in my training, in my work as a writer, as an artist, as a creator. I think it just all kind of came together. And I was 59 when I published that first book. So anyone who's listening, who thinks they're getting too old to do it, you're not.
No, it's, I mean, I always think of the author of A River Runs Through It, who was, I think, in his early 70s when that collection was first published, and very close to 80s or older when the movie actually came out. But it's a brilliant piece of work, you know? And I mean, it takes the time it takes. And you're right, it's never too late. Which, again, a nice sort of artificial segue there, opportunity. The second of the three tentpoles of the show is talking about what success means for each of us. Tell us a little bit about that. What does success mean to you as a writer, as an author, as a creator? And where do you think you are along that particular journey?
So I feel successful to have completed a novel. That's the first place in my writer's journey where I had to stop a minute and go, wow, I never thought I could write a novel, because all of my life up until that point was short story, blogs, essays, articles. And I did not think that was in my grasp. Mm-hmm. And I did not have the confidence to admit that I could do it. So the fact that I wrote a novel, as soon as I felt that it was at a point where I could say done, which basically means 10 more iterations to go before I let anyone else see it. But I actually was stunned. I think I stunned myself. And it just gave me, after the pause, the confidence to think, I did it, which means I can do it again. Mm. But I did not think I would. I was so pleased with having completed a novel that I felt that this is going to sound terrible, but I felt like I could die happy. Like, that was, to me, success. And to this day, even though I've now published three novels and other things, and the selling is going okay, I'm enjoying the promo marketing aspect of being an indie writer, even though it takes up a lot of energy and time, I still feel that that was the biggest, the pinnacle of my success, which I reached in that first, finishing that first novel.
That's great. Yeah. And for you in particular, what were some of the, I mean, there's all the sort of rote reasons why a novel is different from a shorter work, but what was it for you that seemed so challenging, so unsurmountable until it wasn't, until it was surmountable?
I think for me, because I've been an avid reader my whole life, and I do love literary and commercial pop fiction. I did not think I was creative enough to do literary fiction. So I had my sites and my beta readers and even some family members who are also writers tell me that the commercial formula, where you introduce characters and setting and a problem, and then they go through this trajectory where they're trying to solve the problem, and then there's a big climax and everybody lives happily ever after. I thought that's what I needed to do, because I thought that really I wasn't creative enough to do literary fiction. So that was not in the cards for me. What actually wound up happening is my first novel is a historical fiction that, as I said before, kind of covers and fictionalizes not just my family history, but my husband's as well. This is like a story that could be told. It involves a lot of different things coming together, a lot of different human stories coming together and trying to make it into that traditional commercial trajectory was just not working. So I decided I was going to take a step back and just write each of the people's stories as a novella style. I'm just going to write the stories. And I did not know what was going to happen at that point. I wrote the stories and I could not see a way to stitch them together. And I had a lot of people telling me this would never work. A lot of people in my surroundings telling me, you know, I really needed to try to find a way to make it fit the formula. And then a friend of mine that I was talking to, also a writer and a creator and someone I've known since I'm 12, said, I'm going to give you this book. And this is a book that is a novel. It tells a story through short stories. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the traditional trajectory. It stitches a story together. If you read the stories, each story from beginning to end of the book, it tells a story. And I read that book, and it wasn't the best book I ever read, but it took me out to the internet where I Googled novels told in short stories and novellas and found out that I was actually in kind of amazing company.
Oh, yes.
Historically. Mm-hmm. And so I wound up taking those stories and putting them together and organizing them in a way that I hope tell the story that I wanted to tell after all. And that just felt, it just felt incredible. It just felt like an accomplishment. And again, I'm not surprised that I wasn't able to follow a formula. I've never been a formula type of person. So yeah, I guess that's what got me to that point.
That's interesting. Just from a craft standpoint, there's such a blurry line between Western storytelling structure and capital F formula, you know, and I know what you're saying, you know, when you mentioned the, you know, introduce the characters, introduce the problem, big crisis, happy ending. But if you broaden that out a little bit, and Western storytelling, we're still used to the same kind of thing, which is, you know, introduce the characters, the situation, the problem ensues. But I think what we're really talking about, and you know, the layperson isn't going to think of it this way, is something changes. Doesn't necessarily have to mean happy ending. It doesn't have to necessarily mean there's, you know, a big cinematic climax where, you know, with literal or metaphorical explosions and drama and yelling and all of that. And so with sort of the mosaic storytelling that you landed on, you referred to this, you said, you know, figured out how, I think you said that put them in the order that made the most sense, that I'm betting that if one were to read this novel, there would still be, you'd still be able to find that arc, that sort of traditional storytelling arc, which is, you know, it's why it works. It's probably why you felt so satisfied, and why you're having, you know, the positive feedback that you're having. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I hope so. As you were talking, I'm saying to myself, that's what one hopes, isn't it?
Well, I mean, if as someone who has so much experience telling stories, if you recognize that, okay, this is done and it's a coherent thing, then you're probably right. It may not be a hit you over the head, obvious, coherent thing. My listeners are going to be tired of hearing me say this at this point, but I'm often and frequently on record as being kind of dismissive about genre distinctions and tropes and staying in one's lane and all that stuff when it comes to fiction. I think that a so-called genre story can also be literary. I think it's where the focus is put. You know, one could write a historical fiction novel and have it be very, quote, pop fiction, unquote, in style. And one could do the same thing and have it be very literary, you know. And people could argue and have argued till the cows come home about which is which. You know, is Pillars of the Earth a literary novel or is it pop fiction? You know, right?
I agree. I think in my case, I was focused on the structure and how the traditional commercially viable structures tend to have that arc. But to me, the fact that it was also historical fiction means that there may or may not be an ending, a happy ending. There's, if you're doing a story that spans generations, there's no ending. It just, it's just a little blip on the human timeline. So how do I structure that kind of book to make it clear?
Well, that's why, and I hear what you're saying, but that's why I think that the story, the events that are portrayed, that doesn't have an ending, right? Because you know these characters are living in a way, and unless they die at the end, their life continues after the last page. But as long as there's some sort of transformation in the character, which if you're telling a historical fiction novel, by default, there's gonna be, you know, if you're dealing with generations of these characters' lives, there's gonna be. So I guess that's what I'm saying is that I think that you have probably achieved the same thing. It's just not, it could be much more subtle than, and maybe that's the difference between so-called pop fiction and so-called literary fiction, is that the beats in the story don't have to literally beat you over the head.
I sometimes feel like, because this is something I'm still learning about, that part of the difference between those is really how much work it takes on the reader's part to understand the writer's message or to get some message out of it or to find some meaning in the reading. So as an educator, we had terms for the kinds of books we offered our students. One of them was beach books, which would have been those very commercially popular books, Goosebumps, or we called those beach books because they sucked you in at the beginning and they spit you out at the end and you felt great and it really did not take much effort to think about what was happening, how deep the characters were, what effect this is going to have on my life. It's pure entertainment, relaxation, escape, and there's always room for that. But then we would give the children much more what I considered, and they as well considered, much more challenging books where they had to stop and talk to someone about it to share what they were thinking. It wasn't a beginning, middle, end read through. It was more the kind of book that we had little literacy book clubs with small groups of children and the teacher, where we would stop at a certain point and say, wow, what did you think of that? So two very different ways of approaching the books, and there's room for all of them.
Absolutely.
But the other thing I wanted to touch on, which kind of piggybacks on that, is one of my favorite literacy gurus talked about the transactional aspect of reading, which is that, and you mentioned it as well, we can have 100 people read the same exact book at the same exact time and come away with 100 different thoughts about what it was about, what it meant, how it affected them, what, you know, at the most basic, whether they liked it or not, whether they related to it or not, whether they thought it was a good book or not. And that's the transactional theory of reading. And as a creator, you don't have any control over that. Like if you and I go to a museum together and we're looking at a Van Gogh piece, I could be in tears. You could be laughing and the person next to us could be scratching their head and saying, my 3-year-old could do this.
Right. Yeah.
And there's no control for the creator over how someone reacts to your work. I think the best I can do as a creator is to satisfy myself and have my beta readers and friends who read it and editors tell me that it's just not awful. in that it's like readable and grammatically correct and has some redeeming qualities. But there, I mean, I've gotten 5-star reviews and 1-star reviews, and actually enjoy them all because it means I impacted somebody emotionally, whether it was good or bad. It impacted them enough to write a review. And I appreciate the time they took to read it, the time they took to write it, and the time it takes to actually put a review on Goodreads or Amazon. To me, it's all the same as long as they read it and were somehow emotionally affected by it, whether it was positive or negative, really.
And it's interesting to me, what you just talked about, that it was referred to as a transactional experience. I think of it as a collaborative experience between the writer and the reader. I think that, and this is, you know, talk about, you know, we talked about sort of lofty thoughts about all this stuff. My lofty thought, perhaps my loftiest, is that as writers, what we're doing isn't really art until it's experienced by the reader. Just for us. It only serves us until we present the opportunity for it to be experienced by somebody else. I'm not sure that we have no control over their experience. I think we can steer them and guide them with the words we choose and the pacing and even the length of the paragraphs and all of that. I agree with everything you're saying. I tend to think of it more as collaborative than transactional.
I love that. I think my point is we have no control over their reaction to
it. Oh, no. Right.
Because they come to it through their own filters.
Exactly. And that's,
I've had people read my first novel and tell me they could barely get through it because it was so hard to imagine what these people went through. And I had another colleague who read it. We did a book group together afterwards, and she loves history. And she was saying, she's quite a bit younger than me, she would say things like, I will never complain about my coffee not being hot enough again, about a TV show being preempted. Like, I'm just, I just realized how petty my complaints are. And it changed the way she viewed her life. Mm-hmm. And to both of those readers, I just appreciate that they came to the book through their own emotional filters, experiential filters. And that's the kind of thing that a creator has zero control over. Their reactions.
Right. Yeah, that's for sure.
Are very, very, very personal.
It reminds me of one of the things, another one of the things that I'm always saying is that I make things for people who like the kinds of things I make.
I read that somewhere and I actually love that.
Yeah. Well, because you can't force anyone to, you know, so if everybody, you know, everybody who takes a shot at it, awesome. Thank you. And if it's not for you, that's fine.
It is fine.
Plenty of other stuff out there in the world. So you mentioned that the big feeling of success came from just finishing that first novel. And there's been, you know, a few more, and you've got the short story collection. Is there a new hurdle, a new line in the sand that you're looking forward to in terms of success at this point? Or
so being an indie author means I'm in charge of everything. Mm-hmm. And the way that it's been playing out for me, and I'm not sure it's the same for everyone, is that I'll publish a novel. I published the three of them and then spent the next 6 months to a year involved in promo marketing and social networking and connections and doing a lot of blogging and article writing and author talks and book signings and podcasts. So that's where I am right now. So I don't see the next hurdle yet. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure it will come because that's the way things have played out. But because I'm so fortunate, I don't use the money from my book sales to pay my bills. I am a very fortunate human. So I don't have the obligation to continue writing novels and putting them out there and trying to sell like mad.
Right.
So I kind of just take it when it comes. So after my first book, I was in the middle of promo marketing and I had literally no intentions of ever writing another. I was so satisfied. I was so pleased with my damn self. And then, and this goes to what we were talking about before the podcast started about the name of your podcast, Sonitatum.
Sonitotum.
Dang it. I almost said it right. That it was
just think, of Sonic Factotum.
I'm telling you, I studied it. But anyway, you made that word up and I still can't. What happened to me is I was in the middle of one of my writers groups online and someone oddly, weirdly posted a word of the day. Now, that's not something this group had ever done before. Hmm. And I'm not, it's kismet or whatever. I don't know what I believe, but the word was sonder. And if you or your writers or your audience are not familiar with it, it is a term that came out of a book that is now on the New York Times bestsellers list. It's called The Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows. And the writer of that book, who is a multicultural, multilinguist, who now resides in the States, came to realize that there were a lot of words in other languages that he spoke that English did not have terms for. Mm-hmm. And sonder was one of those. And it literally gobsmacked me, punched me right between the eyes. The definition of sonder, which is something I actually been doing my whole life, and it'll tie back nicely with the beginning of this podcast, is the realization that every single person you pass on the street, every lighted window that you drive past at night is a human being with a story and a life as rich and complex as your own that you'll never know. And that if you happen to be sitting in a park, you're basically an extra in their life story. And in some ways, they're an extra in yours. And to someone who loves story, the concept and the word itself really struck a chord. And that day, I started writing my second novel. And so I wrote that book and realized again, the format wasn't going to be that commercial arc. So what I did with that book is that I inserted this because it's Sonder and she takes it to the next level where she doesn't just realize these people have a story, she engages them. Mm. And so embedded in the book are their life stories. So again, it's not a traditional format. It's more of a literary format. But it was kind of an accident. And when it was done and I felt amazed, I thought, well, that's it. I'm good. That'll never happen again. And then about a year later, it happened again. So I don't know what to say. Yeah. I don't know what's coming next and I'm open for it. I'm here.
That's inspiration, right? That's how the muse strikes. This is a very sort of amusing, well, I think it's amusing aside about that, but the meaning behind that word sonder, that, you know, their realization that every person has their story and we're never going to know them. I as happens, I kind of randomly ended up watching a short video of a man. It was a man on the street kind of thing. And he was interviewing a flat earther. And the point that the flat earther kept making was that the sun wasn't real, that in fact, every person on earth has their own sun that is never more than 50 miles away from them. And granted, that's wacky, but I loved the metaphor.
Right, exactly. I could definitely see that becoming like a Ray Bradbury short story.
Right? Yeah, the poetry in that, in this guy on the street who was absolutely committed to this concept, the poetry in that was, it was like, okay, file that one away.
never know where the inspiration is going to come from. You really don't.
So it sounds like you've got a pretty good handle on your approach to the writing life. And if that's not the case, or if you have other feelings about that, that's what I'd like to talk about next is, you know, it's that other part of this show, which is staying healthy and sane in the process of creating stuff and finding success as we define it. Do you have any practices or rituals or just general ways of being that help you with all aspects of this as an independent creator? You're dealing with all of it, soup to nuts, you know. What can you tell me about how you handle the healthy, sane part of the whole process?
Yeah, great question. For me, routine is really key. So whether I'm working on a novel or in the middle, like I am now, marketing and promoting, morning times into maybe 1 PM is dedicated to creating. And I have an office that looks out at the forest, and right now it's snowing here in New York, and it's so beautiful. And I have a lot of light that comes in, and I sit at my desk and I create. And I will get up I'm a very physically active person too. So I will get up at least once an hour and do some kind of what some people are now calling exercise snack, which basically means some kind of quick movement thing or weight training thing. So for me, the routine of knowing this is what my day is going to be like. And so I plan around any other errands I have to do or even want to do come afternoon or 1 o'clock, Monday to Friday. Weekends, I'm off. Once I retired, I kind of stuck with the Monday to Friday thing. Mm-hmm. My husband's also retired. So we enjoy a cocktail, but we actually wait till Friday because as retirees, it would be very easy that every day is Saturday and, you know, just very disruptive. And we do know people who do that. And that's not the life that we see for ourselves. So we're on a Monday to Friday thing still, self-imposed. And it really works to think of this as my job now. And I'm my own boss, but still. What I do when I get, I don't like the term writer's block. But when I get stuck, I'm working on something, a piece of writing, and I just go blank. And no matter how hard I try, just the muse or whatever it is taking a vacay. I will put on my sneakers and go for a long run, which I actually try to do every day, depending on the weather and the season. If it's summertime, I'll get up early and do it before I start writing. Mm-hmm. In the winter, I usually go in the afternoon. Running and working out, strength training, making sure that I take care of the physical side of myself is what keeps the rest of it going. So I've been into working out since I was probably in my 20s when flash dance aerobics was a thing.
Sure.
I had the leg warmers and everything, like the headband, like I was flash dancing every day. And, you know, teaching and raising children and writing and all those things were vying for time. Mm-hmm. So taking care of your physical self, getting enough sleep, having other kinds of fun. My husband and I love to watch series on TV. We love to travel. So trying to find the balance, trying to make time for everything is probably the most challenging thing. And that's why I have to carve out and just not allow myself to say not today, so that I can feel accomplished in my creativity every day, except weekends when I'm free.
And since you are fortunate enough to be at the stage where you're retired, and it sounds like your kids are all grown and out of the house, you don't have routines are wonderful, but it can be very difficult to to put it bluntly, enforce those routines. You know, we can tell ourselves we're going to do that, but the world doesn't always agree. So yeah, it sounds like everybody's in accord. And apart from, of course, the unexpected and the unforeseen and the unavoidable things that pop up, you know, if a pipe breaks, you're not going to wait until 1 o'clock, but
I mean, I'd be tempted, but yes, I do allow things like that. I do turn my phone off though. Mm. Because I have a lot of friends who call, family members who call, and it's, and again, because I love my people, I will talk on the phone for an hour or two. Like this conversation with you feels just like one of those things. It right. It's very easy to do. So I turn my phone off. But of course, yes, barring emergencies, I do force myself to stick to that because, as I said, it would be very easy not to do that. And I don't think as a retiree that I would be happy getting up and not knowing what I was going to do during the day. And I think the biggest complaint I hear from other retirees is they're bored. They don't know what to do. And I'm thinking, how are you bored? I don't even know how I had time for a job, you know, and a family with this life I'm leading. So I don't know, you know, how people are bored. And I just try to tell them to, they need to find their creator self. Mm-hmm. Both my husband and I did that. The day he sold his company, he took a chainsaw outside and started doing carving with a chainsaw.
Lovely.
And I'm watching this man that I was married to for 40 years doing something I had never seen him do before. But our yard is now full of chainsaw sculptures, and people who ride their bikes or drive by will stop and come in and take photos. And he's right now in the garage painting, like making paintings. And this is nothing he ever did before that. So I think people need to kind of let go when it's their turn to let go of that ritual of working and having someone else have expectations of you and meeting deadlines, and really tap into the things you didn't have time for. And then finding the balance, finding your structure.
And even if there are no external pressures to break up the routine, how do you, what have you struck upon to battle, you know, one's own tendencies to stray from these routines? Whether it's, I mean, like, you know, you mentioned you get up once an hour. I know a lot of people will use like the Pomodoro method or some other sort of interval timer that you know, reminds them. What do you do to keep yourself on task and disciplined?
So I was never diagnosed with ADD, but my children seem to think I have it. And based on what I'm doing and what I've done with my life, I think they're probably right, because it is fairly easy for me to get distracted by things. I think never having been diagnosed means that I've learned to compensate and redirect myself by brute force. And I think that it's actually helped me in this endeavor now, that I'm able to go, nope, you are not going shoe shopping online. I actually impose deadlines on myself. Mm-hmm. When I'm in the middle of writing novels, I'll say minimum of 1,000 words before I can say done. So I do self-impose deadlines, and I just work hard to keep myself honest. But I do think, because of my character and my upbringing, nature and nurture and all that, I'm able to be a really good boss to myself somehow.
Do you incorporate positive or negative consequences around those self-imposed deadlines?
I think the positive consequences are generally just feeling happy and content with myself.
Look what I did. Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of negative consequences, but I do have certain routines that I feel like I earn, even though I probably do them, even if I don't earn them, and then maybe feel guilty. Mm. But for example, this is, you know, it's one of those things. I will take myself out for ice cream every Wednesday afternoon. And if it's Wednesday afternoon and I do not feel content with what I've done, then I will guilt myself into getting back on task after the fact and be like, you know, you really didn't earn it this week, but I do it anyway. So I'm not too hard on myself.
Oh, that's great. It's like, you know, I'm going to have the ice cream anyway. I'm just going to be aware of myself that I'm doing
it. I mean, being a workout fiend means I am super disciplined in what I eat. And even when we do have drinks, I mean, I'm super disciplined about what it all means. And I'm very disciplined as far as my intake, my expenditure of exercise. I'm very, very disciplined. I have a friend who's diabetic and she said, I've never met anyone as disciplined as you with all this stuff. And so I think I've just, like I said earlier, learned to compensate. But no, I'm not too hard on myself. I think the guilty feelings and the feelings of accomplishment at this point in my life are enough to keep me honest.
And I think too, you have built up a practice, especially with the physical activity, you've built up a practice over what, 40 years. So it's almost like that's translated into something that serves you well in the writing routines, because you're 100%. You're already someone who's used to, this is just what I do.
Right? I think that is so true. And I think it's an advantage of being older because, first of all, I don't have to worry about what people think of me, where I did when I was teaching every day. I was being judged by everybody. Mm-hmm. I was parenting my children, I was likely being judged by everybody on how I was doing with that. And so
starting
now,
with your children.
Right. And so now I feel like, you know, one big advantage of being over 60 and being retired and being a fortunate human is that I don't have to worry about that anymore. And so it's just me and what I do for myself. And it's kind of awesome.
That's a wisdom that can apply at any age. I think obviously there are things like employment, performance reviews and things like that. But I think we tend to over depend on what others might think of us, and we allow that to influence us. Maybe we don't have to.
I actually recently wrote an article for Substack about that. I think the title is Judge Not. And the whole idea is that when you allow other people to judge you, you're actually getting in your own way.
That's right.
It's not real. And, the whole article really started with a recent conversation with someone my age, a friend I've known for a long time, who's kind of one of those failure to launch, never really did what never met her potential and is feeling pretty badly about it. And she said, it's just that I always felt so judged. And I thought, wow, even at our age, to continue to allow other people's opinions of you to impede your, reach towards what would be your self-actualization, to quote Maslow, is shocking to me. And so I agree with you. I think, though, when you're younger, it's probably physiologically part of what we do that it gets in. Gets in and it bothers us and it stops us from doing things that would be amazing if we could do it. So I just wish everybody cut it out.
I wish people knock that off.
Cut it out. And I wish the people who allowed that to impede their progress would also just cut it out, because if you can reach your potential, that's your life goal, then no one else can tell you what it is, whatever it is. We all benefit, humanity benefits when anybody does reach their potential. So I don't know what we're doing.
Well, I think you may have already covered it, but one of the things I like to ask toward the end of these conversations is if you could distill everything that you've learned, the wisdom that you've acquired, the lessons that you've been able to apply across your creative writing life, if you could bring that down to a bumper sticker or a pithy phrase that would go on your morning coffee mug, what might that be?
I think if I put it all together, it would say, get out of your own way. Just kind of reach for those things you want to do. Get out of your own way. Let it happen. Be confident.
Yeah.
Because really, without that, you're not going to be able to do the things you want to do. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of our problems is us getting in our own way.
Right,
Circumstances being perfect, that would be the biggest problem. Of course, a lot of people don't have perfect circumstances, and I don't want to insinuate they do. But I think a lot of times we just don't do what we want to do. And if you can reach towards even the small goals, like have a goal and then reach for it and keep reaching.
Yeah. You know, there's I've got it up on my wall. This circulated a few years ago. It's called the Cult of Done Manifesto. I don't know if you've heard of this, but a lot of it is about that. And this Cult of Done Manifesto is just a one page thing with these various little one sentence things. And one of them is failure counts as done. You know, even if you fail at something, well, yeah, you finished something, you did it. You know, and it's that same thing. You know, we can't wait for perfection. We can't waiting for perfection is a form of procrastination. You know, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this, but I think procrastination is coming back around to that self-esteem thing. Procrastination is a symptom of fear, right? It's a symptom of what will the consequences be if I actually finish this thing. You know,
a lot of times it's that fear of being judged,
right?
Judged negatively,
or even being judged positively, because then you have to live up to that.
Oh, interesting.
Right. I think that is a factor. There's a thing that I'm guilty of, which I call procrastination, where I will find all the sort of, secondary and tertiary and auxiliary tasks involved in a creative project and do those anything but actually do the writing, because the writing is the thing that's the hardest. The writing is the thing that takes the most mental and emotional and physical energy, speaking for myself. And I'm sure part of that is also that the writing is the actual thing that ultimately will have consequences, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, get out of your own way is a wonderful thing. I might put that on a mug myself.
Put that on a wall.
Yeah, and it's lovely, because the more folks like you that I talk to, the more writers and in whatever field I've talked to, playwrights and fiction and nonfiction authors and memoirists and all sorts of different genres, different ages, different stages in their creative life. When I get to that bumper sticker question, everyone, no matter where they're at, they have something good to say, because we've all figured part of this out, you know?
Maybe you should put together a collection of those.
Yeah, it may be.
The world. The one issue is, if you're not ready to learn that lesson,
oh, yes,
I could say it till the cows come home.
That's right.
You're just going to say, you don't understand.
That's like, right. That's
all right. Yeah,
that's,
when you do get out of your own way, you remember I said it first.
I think it's a constant process. I don't think we're ever done.
I agree with that. Lifelong learner here.
Yep. You got to be. So is there anything over this course of the conversation that you wish we had spent more time on, that we maybe that has come up like 20 minutes after the fact, where you're like, ooh, I want to go back and say this or that? Anything that you wanted to add or even even say, hey, Matt, maybe we don't include that in the public version of the show?
No, I think it was pretty comprehensive. I think we covered a lot, and I really enjoyed the conversation. I'm just sitting here because you can take the girl out of the classroom. you can't take the classroom out of the girl, I guess, that I'm hoping your listeners get something out of the conversation. But
I'm sure they will. That's the whole point to this. And, you know, it comes back to that making things for the people who actually want those things. The listeners are folks who want these kinds of conversations, who are looking for that evergreen experience and wisdom that they can take. And again, even if they're not ready for it now, the lovely thing about something like this is it'll be there for them, you know, 6 months, a year, 5 years down the line. Mission accomplished, I would certainly say.
Excellent. And then the other thing is, I know you're going to be sharing my contact information. I would love to hear from some of your listeners their opinions on things that we talked about, because to me, if, you know, you and I have had an exchange, but there is an audience for this exchange, and I would love to hear from them about their thoughts on what was said.
That is great to hear. I always encourage, there's a thing I record before this portion and a thing I record after this portion. I always encourage folks to provide feedback in whatever way that they are comfortable with. I, of course, will have links to your stuff in the show notes so they can reach out to you directly. Also, of course, the show notes will have a comments section there that they can leave on my site. If any of those, if any of the listeners want to direct a comment that's written on the show notes to you, I'll make sure that you know about it when it pops up so you can come over there and respond.
I mean, being a lifelong learner, being someone who's open, and building on what I said before about good and bad reviews, I learn from people when they say, well, this is what you said, and I disagree with that because I'm listening with my whole body, mm-hmm. because yeah. I may wind up going, no, you're definitely wrong and I'm right, which could happen. Or I might go, I never really thought about it that way. Let me give this some thought. And you never know, it could change something that I do. And I'm open for that.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. I think sometimes conversations like this and are a matter of figuring out what you think as you're thinking it, sometimes I have guests who have little mini revelations just because, I've never really thought of it quite like that. And so there's always, doors are always opening.
Oh, I agree. I mean, your comment on looking at the transactional view of reading, and you looked at it more as a collaborative view, is something I've never thought about. So I will definitely be giving that some more thought.
Yeah, that's one of my little little hills that I die on, my little flags that I plant. As I said earlier, regular listeners will be like, here he goes again. But I'll keep saying it. Well, Maureen, thank you so much for taking the time to do this conversation. It's been a blast.
Thank you, Matthew, for taking the time to create these really important give and takes, conversations, put it out there. And I think all of it, I had said before, like a ripple continues to echo. And I just really appreciate the time you took. So thank you.
There it is, my friends. There is my conversation with Maureen Morrissey, historical fiction and family history fiction author. Hope you dug it. If you dug it, if you have any thoughts about that conversation, the things that Maureen had to say, her message of getting out of your own way, and all the other stuff about her path to becoming at this moment, three-time novelist and counting, then I hope you will consider leaving a comment for this episode over there at mattselznick.com/sonitotum-099. You can also, of course, simply email me at matt@mattselznick.com. And by the way, Matt Selznick is spelled MattSelznick. Send me an email, or even record a short voice message on your phone and email that to me. Or, of course, leave a comment right there in the show notes at mattselznick.com/sonitotum-099. This is meant to be a conversation, not just between me and the lovely authors who appear on the show, but also between you and I, right? This is a community of sorts. It's not just me speaking into this microphone. It's me talking to each one of you individually and collectively all at once, because that's the magic of podcasting, right? Hey, speaking of community, I want to take this moment to thank my Multiversalist patron members, the members of my Multiversalist community who are contributing anywhere from $5 a month on up to support this show and the community and my other creative endeavors. Thank you, as always, and once again, to Zoe Lay, J.C. Hutchins, Jim Lewinson, Amelia Bowen, and Ted Lainhart. If you would like to become a member patron of the Multiversalists, simply go to mattselznick.com/BAPatron, and you'll find out all about the perks and privileges of being a patron member. If you just want to become a Multiversalist at the free level and become part of the mailing list community and get access to the novel length ongoing serial that I've provided for members, Hazy Days and Cloudy Nights, kind of an 80s new adult soap opera in text form, but I promise you it's a lot of fun, pretty good too, then again, just go to mattselznick.com/BAPatron and you'll see all the details there. I want to say again, I'm so grateful to my patrons. And here's one of the neat things that my patrons actually did for the community and for me and for the world at large, if I may be if I could add some hubris into the mix there. We have a goal. We have several goals, right, as the community as a whole. Any month that the Multiversalist community hits at least 40 active patron members or earns a net revenue from patron members of $175 or more, I write a short story. Well, this happened in January, and the story is finished. It's called Reggie versus Kaiju Storm Dragon Squid Bat. It is a kind of a romp, kind of an adventure, contemporary science fantasy story set in my Daikaiju universe story world, where since the late 18th century, humanity has been periodically plagued by, well, giant monsters, right? The story itself is set kind of present day in this alternate history and deals with yet another adventure of Reggie, whose job it is to pick up after these kaiju storms when they happen, or in this case, try to get there before it happens and investigate. If you love giant monster movies, especially the sort of gonzo late 60s, early 70s Godzilla movies, that style, then this is for you. Reggie versus Kaiju Storm Dragon Squid Bat. It's a novelette, a little over 10,000 words, currently available at my website, mattselznick.com. Just go to mattselznick.com and click on the written works link there on the homepage. It's the spotlighted work right there at the top of the books page. It's currently available in ebook form from my website for $1.99. After the 16th, it will be available pretty much everywhere. Amazon, Google Books, Apple Play, Kobo, Barnes & Noble, Smashwords, all the usual suspects. Wherever you get your ebooks, it'll be out there. However, if it's not yet April 16th, 2024, as you listen to this, and you want to get Reggie versus Kaiju Storm Dragon Squid Bat, and you do, then please do just get it directly from my own website, mattselznick.com. If you do that, I end up getting the highest royalty rate possible, and you become part of the Multiversalists community to boot. So, yeah, new short story, new novelette, 10,000 words, giant monster, fun action. Reggie versus Kaiju Storm, Dragon Squid Bat. That's what's new. And that's news. That's it. I will just close by saying, hey, it's a podcast. So you know what you should do, right? You should subscribe so you never miss an episode anywhere you get your podcasts. And however you do get your podcasts, I would love a rating and or review for Sonatotum. Ratings and reviews, as you know, because you listen to podcasts, they help raise the awareness of the podcast in that podcast platform's directory, whether it's iTunes or Spotify or wherever. The more ratings and reviews a show has, the more eyeballs get drawn to it and the more ears, I suppose, right? So that's it. 2 weeks from now, our next guest will be AJ Super. She writes young adult horror and literary light science fiction and other things. That's in about 2 weeks. But if you subscribe for free anywhere you get your podcasts, well, it'll just show up for you when it's there. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. Take care.